For program information, audio, video and more, head to the RN homepage.
On RN and online at abc.net.au. Hello, Paul Barclay here. Thanks for joining me for Big Ideas. Tonight, confronting cultural stereotypes, we explore some of the issues and realities of Islamophobia in contemporary Australia. In this Sydney seminar event recorded late last year, a new generation of visual artists, novelists and academics discuss creative responses in an era of suspicion and prejudice. Our panellists are Randa Abdel-Fattah, award-winning author and doctoral student researching Islamophobia in the Department of Sociology at Macquarie University. Abdul Abdullah is a visual artist. His works are included in the collections of the National Gallery of Australia and the Islamic Museum of Australia. His painting of sportsman Anthony Mundine was a finalist in the 2013 Archibald Prize. And Yasir Morsi, he's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of South Australia. His area of interest, racism and the struggles facing Muslim minorities living in a secular, post-colonial and liberal West. On Big Ideas, let's head to the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts for highlights of being creative, resisting Islamophobia. Here now to set the scene is our moderator, Associate Professor Alana Lenton from the University of Western Sydney's Institute of Culture and Society.
Yasir and I met last year at a conference that was organised by Deakin University in Melbourne, and I was immediately struck that he was somebody in Australia, to which I've arrived relatively recently, who is working on race from a critical perspective, and I think putting the dominant ideology of liberalism in the spotlight, which is something that I think is necessary to do. And as a Muslim living in Australia has a particular view on what it means to be Muslim in the society, not only in Australia particularly, but in the West at large, and how the ramping up of Islamophobia in the post 9/11 era has had an effect on communities or people thought of as being Muslim. And this is where race and religion, if you like, intersect, because often it's people who are considered to be Muslim who come under the radar of Islamophobic attacks. So brown bodies, as Gargi Bhattacharya would put it when she talks about war on our doorsteps, and not just the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the wars on the doorsteps of brown and black communities. So we sort of thought about what we could do to take this conversation further. And we were very attracted by the idea of thinking about how people outside of academia approach the topic of Islamophobia particularly, but perhaps also the experience of migration in Australia, and how race and questions that come out of the experience of race and racism have an impact on the type of work that they produce creatively. And it's for that reason that we contacted Abdul and Randa, coming from very different artistic practices and fields, but who nonetheless both have thought about the impact of being Muslim in Australia and Islamophobia in their work. So that's kind of all from me at the moment. I'd like to hand over to Yasir to frame it more specifically, and then we'll be hearing from both of our speakers and then taking it back to a conversation with us and then opening it to the floor for a general discussion, which I'm sure will be very fruitful.
Thank you, Alana. And thank you again. I extend the gratitude of all of you coming tonight. Specifically, I guess, in the response of what it means to be Muslim in a time since September 11, although we've often used that as a marker, I think a lot of what preceded September 11 has shaped the kind of world that I've inherited as a brown body or as a Muslim or as a person of colour. But to give a kind of context about how Islamophobia has both shaped my thinking in one way or another, it's become increasingly difficult for me to escape it, exit it. I was just having a casual chat that I'm beginning to see a lot of things through a very racialized lens, beginning to understand my own experience through conversations that have preceded me and me trying to find my place within that conversation. And part of that is to recognize that the pervasiveness of racism and its manifestation, Islamophobia, has multiple registers and subsequently multiple ways to, multiple mediums to express what it means to be Muslim, or not just Muslim, what it means to deal with the Muslim question. Australia, for me, for a long, long time, was a place that was working in the background. I didn't necessarily have a way to articulate, understand, or even put a vocabulary to what was ailing me, what made me feel strange, what made me feel welcomed, what points that I was both loved and hated. And it wasn't until after September 11 when various conversations came about what it meant to be Muslim that I had to explore this new geography of the war and terror to try and find out the kind of norms that were pushing me out of this place, this space. And ironically for me, I mean, I spent 10 years, you know, in without over-dramatizing it, kind of place of exile. I never belonged to Egypt. I never belonged to Australia. I was somewhere in between trying to articulate it. And I was quite angry and I couldn't figure out why. And that anger kind of expressed itself towards anything and everyone. But I found academia eventually. And certain concepts and certain languages and certain ideas helped me articulate and put to words what Islamophobia meant, what its relationship was with racism, and broadly speaking, its history. Racism as a history, an objective history. An objective history that shaped my parents' attitudes towards me. An objective history that shaped my attitude towards my religion and to fellow Muslims and non-Muslims. And it was that trying to put a word to that history, to try and understand it, that became, as I said, eventually would consume my thinking because it was something I couldn't escape. I've said this often, and this is why I find all sorts of works interesting. But as young Muslims in particular, September 11 isn't just important because of the conversation it opened. It was also that moment that I was forced to be politically conscious about what it meant to be Muslim. I had no choice. I had to respond. I had to answer to questions. And those questions, I think, are what enable us to perform our various different types of arts and mediums and intellectual labor. That underlying question, whether it be about loyalty, whether it be about my relationship vis-a-vis whiteness, whether it be about the question of myself as a settler on indigenous land, all sorts of questions became intertwined with one another. And as I said, and I'll maybe conclude on this point, for me, it became increasingly difficult to exit understanding of modernity outside of the racial question. And from that reason and from that moment on, to just attach what I did to Alana's initial point, there was a reason I problematized liberalism. At that moment, I didn't know how or where. It was very early in my PhD. But I had a suspicion that everything that was promised, such as freedom, such as the idea of being able to express myself as much as I wanted to, was not quite what it was. And reading plenty of race theorists inevitably gave me a broader understanding of history and how I came to where I am today. And if in that sense, I think the different mediums help articulate the same question. I might want to introduce Abdul here's work. Just a very quick anecdote about how I met his work. Part of that anger, I visited recently the Islamic Museum of Australia. And I'm not sure if any of you have been. It's a great initiative, but walking, I think it was opened in 2010-11. Or
yeah, very recently.
Yeah, and it was for me, I found it very sterile. I found it was telling a very optimistic story. It highlighted the integrated Muslim, quote unquote, whatever that meant. It was part and parcel of a similar narrative. A path that where I should be rather than where I was. And I'll be honest about it, it didn't reflect any anger I had about, I was like, where's the blood? there wasn't stories about Islamophobia, there wasn't stories about racism that I thought shaped the migrantry experience. There wasn't class conflict either. I mean, I started imagining an alternative, of all the struggles I had, you know, even between my parents' generation and myself about the expectations and whatnot. And I just felt the museum was all about a celebration. And I felt, well, yes, maybe ideally, but that's not my story. Whether it's our story or not, that's not my story. And then on the second level, there's this plastic camel, and that did it for me. Like, I was like, okay. There was this moment I shared with the camel. I'm like, of course you're in this museum. But there was a key moment that it all kind of faded into the background, and it was your painting of Walid Ali. And I stared into this painting, and it took me away a bit, and it captured precisely what I was looking for. Now, I didn't just want dread. A lot of my thesis was about these dual drives that Nietzsche speaks about, the Apollonian and the Dionysian. The Apollonian is this optimistic notion of form and illusion, but the Dionysian is our state of drunkenness and our state of being brought into a world of dismay and so forth. There's two kind of human drives. And Nietzsche looks for a synthesis, and I thought your painting brought that for me. And anybody who knows me knows I've always been a critic of Walid Ali's politics, but here he was, and I was like, my brother. The painting had this wonderful aura, wonderful synthesis, where it was Apollonian in form, but it captured that kind of Dionysian notion of being taken away, something greater and larger than you. And it was the saving grace for me from the museum, and I thought it captured that notion of the Muslim. In a sense, there was a bit of blood, a bit of aura around it. And, kind of like a zombie figure, we're alive, we're dead, we're here, we're not quite there, we're undecidable, we're ambiguous. And that kind of art, it did everything that I was trying to say in 80,000 words. It did it perfectly, and that's how we met. And I guess the first question I'd like to ask you before I let you introduce your own work was, yeah. How much of it was cognitive? How much of what you were trying to translate, or whether it was instinctive in a sense?
I've been a big fan of Walid Ali since my dad gave me a book of his, People Like Us, maybe in 2010 when I moved to Melbourne. And it really reintroduced me to the religion and sort of like reinvigorated my interest in it. But I think there was a turmoil in Walid Ali. There was there's that conflict, that unreconciled part of us. That's part of all of us that have been through this experience. And it wasn't necessarily put across on television. So I wanted to put across that sense of turmoil, or that sense of conflict, or that sense of burden. So there's a lot of space around him on the canvas, and I wanted that space, like an imaginary space, where that's his thought space, and a lot's going on, but it might not necessarily show. But it's he's carrying that on him, and he's thinking deeply about stuff.
I got that sense of turmoil. I mean, that's the part that attracted me. That's the part that was missing in the museum for me. It was that sense of turmoil. There's a moment where he's glancing, and it feels like he's glancing at the problem, or that he's burdened with the issue. And that sense of burden, as I said, I felt like a lot of us had to be political, even if we didn't have a choice. I mean, I grew up just wanting to watch them play cricket and, just be whatever normal meant. But next thing you know, I had to read up on US foreign policy in order to respond to a relative or somebody at university, because I was charged with all sorts of connotations of being backwards and evil and Taliban-like. But that sense of turmoil, I often feel like all of us have to articulate. Do you sense it as well through your work or through, just by generally being a public figure as a Muslim?
You're always trying to work out what are the limits to what you can say, because there are limits that are imposed on you and you always want to push against them. But as a writer, it's almost a double consciousness. I write because I love being creative and I love the written word. But at the same time, there are barriers, because there's the Muslim community who want me to write in a way that appeases the wider majority and make us look good and, make sure your characters are... almost a sense that my books are a means for showing the better part of the Muslim community. So good Muslim, bad Muslim. And that when you try and assert the fact that you're a writer and you're not writing to convey a message or to preach or to represent a community, there's a real struggle there. There are limits to what I can say in my books because of those pressures. And then on the other hand, there are those who would typecast me as, or who would refer to me, for example, in an interview as a Muslim writer. Mm. Because I happen to write, some of my books happen to have Muslim characters. There's never any consciousness that an Anglo writer who happens to write books about Anglos would never be referred to as an Anglo writer or a white writer. But that's a burden that you carry, because there's this perception that your work is somehow an exotic deviation from a white norm. And so even though they're trying to celebrate your voice, at the same time they're pigeonholing you and always measuring it against that white centrality. And that's a burden you carry as well. Sometimes it serves its purpose, because you want to capitalise on the interest and the lack of books that have a Muslim voice. But most times it frustrates me to be introduced as a Muslim writer, because Muslim is not a neutral term, and it implies that my writing isn't self-determined, that it's responsive or reactive.
Mm. Yes, it also, like, very quickly prefigures the debate on what you can say often. Like, when I get introduced as a Muslim, this and that, it's almost basically saying there's a series of expectations of what is expected for you to say, and half of that expectation, as you said, is to play the normal, good, integrated world, to do Australian Muslim. And the more you deviate, the more difficult it becomes.
Well, in fact, when Does My Head Look Big In This, my first novel, came out, one of the reviewers advised me in her review that it was good that I'd written a book about a Muslim girl, but it was now time to write about other normal characters. So she was almost trying to give me some career advice, that if I wanted to succeed, I had to sort of step away from that exotic niche and start to write about the majority.
Maybe this is a good point at which to ask Abdul to make a brief presentation about his work.
Yeah, fantastic.
Would you like to do that?
Thank you so much. My name's Abdul Abdullah, or as my parents call me, Abdul Hamid bin Ibrahim bin Abdullah, but I go by Abdul Abdullah for short. I've come from a pretty conservative background. My mother's from Malaysia, and she met my dad in the early 70s while he was studying in Malaysia, and he's a white Australian, a sixth generation white Australian, and he converted to Islam in 1972. At different periods, he was a secretary for the Federation of Australian Islamic Councils, and was a project manager at Malik Fahad Islamic School in Sydney, and a principal of Thornley Islamic College back in Perth, where I'm from. That being said, they had three boys who all went through art school, and I'm the youngest. We're all called Abdul, Abdul Karim on that side, Abdul Rahman with the dreadlocks, and I'm in the middle. Abdul Karim, Abdul Rahman, and Abdul Hamid. The oldest, he now runs the art departments in West Australian Correctional Services. He has to go to jail every day. I don't really, envy that. And my other brother, he worked for a long time as a commercial sculptor, and he's recently come over to making art, and he's doing really well. And our older sister, who's not pictured, she's the boss of the family, and she owns a boxing gym. When I left art school, I was primarily a painter and just sort of painted things. It wasn't very conceptually rigorous, but politics is something I've always been interested in, and it's always something that's driven me. Like, I when I was a teenager, I made really angsty political songs and no one listened to them. But I found that art has a more patient audience. So in 2011, I had a show in Melbourne called Them and Us, and I was talking about that sort of just under the surface tension. And like, I'm 28 years old, born in 1986, and I feel like, I might be wrong, but I feel like I'm in the older cusp of a generation that has grown up post 9/11. Like, it's a big difference between my art and my brother's art, and he's born in 1977. Like, he's just, like, talking about his ethnic background and his culture, but he's also, but it's very nostalgic, and it's very almost sweet in its memory, while mine is a lot more politicised. This is it for the opening of the show. And Walid Ali, there he is, he opened it in front of a portrait of my father. And it's the first time I had an exhibition that had no paintings in it. It was two photographs, six-channel video, and a big light box. Now, this was the title piece for the show, and it was called Them and Us. It was also won the Blake Prize for Human Justice in Sydney. And I got the tattoo. It's myself in the foreground and my brother in the background. And I got the tattoo with a crescent moon and Southern Cross, particularly for this work. So I've kind of got the work forever.
piece of art.
It was interesting when it was shown in Sydney and it got a little bit of press, because the Blake Prize is a religious art prize, and Khalid Sabsabi won the main prize and I won the human justice part. So two Muslims had taken out the prize, and it kind of pissed people off. The member for the Christian Democratic Party said that I was trying to convert young Australians and that I worshipped a moon god. And there was like letters in the paper. It was a bizarre time. In fact, after I painted Walid Ali in Archibald, that was the first time I got sort of an influx of hate mail. It was really bizarre. And when the Archibald toured to Tarawarra, I went and visited it. And one of the gallery sitters said to me that he'd never come across such a polarizing painting. And it's not, I didn't find it particularly like, there was nothing crazy about the painting, but it was the fact that it was a painting of Walid Ali and a person called Abdul had painted it, and that sort of messed with people. So either people liked it or they hated it, but they didn't really hate it for the painting's sake, or they didn't like the way that it was painted. It was just who it was and who painted it.
Visual artist Abdul Abdullah, and you can see a portfolio of his work online. We'll post the link on the Big Ideas homepage, abc.net.au/rn. Also on tonight's panel, we have postdoctoral research fellow at the University of South Australia, Yasir Morsi. And to continue this conversation on creative responses to Islamophobia, he is the award-winning author and doctoral student at Macquarie University, Randa Abdel Fattah.
I'm Australian-born Muslim, Palestinian, Egyptian, so it was a recipe for an identity crisis coming up. And I came of age at the time of the first Gulf War. I was attending Australia's first Islamic school, and we felt the direct impact on our school community as Muslim girls wearing hijab of this sudden, you know, positioning of Muslims and Arabs, which were considered synonymous, as the other. At our Islamic school, we had a pig's head thrown through the office. We had an arson attack. We had the school bus couldn't have its name, which was King Khalid Islamic College, because of the vandalism. And as Muslim girls wearing hijab, we were quite vulnerable in the streets. Out of that experience of suddenly being positioned as the other at an incredibly confusing time, adolescence, where you're already trying to figure out your place in the world and your identity, I started to think as a 15-year-old what I could do to try and reinvent the image of Muslims, or to reclaim what it meant to be a Muslim woman in public imagination. When I was in year 9, when I was 15, wearing the veil, the hijab, I was attacked at Darling Harbour when we were visiting family. A group of boys chased me down the food court and ripped the veil off my head and then encircled me. And it was a time where I felt extremely vulnerable, but it really was a catalyst for me deciding that I wanted to really take ownership of my story as a Muslim woman. Before I read a very brief extract from my book, I wanted to read a quote by acclaimed Nigerian author Chimamanda Adichie. She speaks about the danger of a single story, and what she says really resonates with me. She says, "Like our economic and political worlds, stories too are defined by the principle of power. How they are told, who tells them, when they're told, how many stories are told are really dependent on power. Power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person." And so when I was 15, I realized that the definitive story of being Muslim was that you were either a terrorist or that you were an oppressed woman. And I wanted to really cut through all of that and reclaim the right to define myself. So I wrote the first draft of my first novel, Does My Head Look Big In This? But I was 15 and it was pretty bad. It was really preachy and didactic. I put it aside, got on with high school, became a lawyer. September 11 occurred. I got married and moved from Melbourne to Sydney. And I realized that when I went to bookstores, the only books that were lining the shelves that contained Muslim characters were books like you see on the PowerPoint here. So books in which, I mean, this is a whole genre in itself, and you can make a lot of money in this industry writing these kinds of books. Books in which Muslim women are either mute and their story is conveyed through the voice of their noble, Western woman who's come to the rescue of the Muslim woman and told her story, or books in which the Muslim woman is oppressed by Islam. There's familiar tropes in these sorts of books. There's inevitably a tyrannical father. Most of the men in the books are misogynists. There's the paradox of the strong woman who manages to escape her oppression, but that's usually done because she has, you know, relieved herself of the shackles of her faith. And so it's because she's turned away from Islam and rejected her faith that she's found liberation. So these are the sorts of recipes, if you like, to write a best-selling book. And, you know, books like Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women by Geraldine Brooks, were and are still are bestsellers because they fit within this, Orientalist tradition of trying to uncover, unmask, unveil the Muslim woman. This idea, this presumption, this arrogant presumption that the Muslim woman can be known, that the Muslim woman can be understood as though she's a homogenous entity. And I wanted very much to offer an alternative narrative on my own terms. And I revisited that initial manuscript and I couldn't get past the first page. It was pretty bad. So I decided that I would rewrite it. And I wanted to write for young adults. I wanted to get into the headspace of an adolescent Muslim teenager growing up post-September 11. And I wrote the draft in 2003, 2004. And it's basically a story about a young Muslim girl who's growing up in Melbourne who decides to wear the hijab while she's attending a private school in one of Melbourne's snobby suburbs, and she's one of the only Muslims there. And it's a celebration of her decision and her conviction, but also a means of readers understanding the immense courage it takes to wear a symbol that is associated with oppression and associated with so many negative signifiers, but also to try and convey her struggles against people's misconceptions and her journey coming of age as a Muslim teenager. I'm going to read just a very short scene from the book. It's a scene where Amal has started wearing the veil, and she's made this decision during the school holidays, so she arrives after the school holidays suddenly wearing the veil. Monday morning, and my class has finally decided to confront me about my hijab. I almost want to jump up and down with relief. I can handle an insult or an interrogation. I can't handle going from getting along with everybody to being a social outcast. Somehow, in between classes after lunch on Monday, everybody suddenly finds the guts to approach me, wanting to know what's going on with my new look. "Did your parents force you?" Christy asks, all wide-eyed and appalled. "Yeah, my dad told me if I don't wear it, he'll marry me off to a 65-year-old camel owner in Egypt." "No," she's actually horrified. "I was invited to the wedding," my friend Eileen adds. "Really?" This is definitely a case of drop from the cradle. "Hey, Amal," Tim calls out. "What's the deal with that thing on your head?" "I've gone bald." "Get out." "Yeah, I'm on the advanced hair program." For a second, his eyes flicker with shock. Then Josh punches him on the shoulder. "Rocked. Like I believed her," Tim says, looking sheepish. "Doesn't it get hot?" someone asks. "Can I touch it? Can you swim? Do you wear it in the shower? So is it like nuns? Are you married to Jesus now?" It's unreal. Everybody's asking me about my decision and seems genuinely interested in hearing what I have to say. They're all huddled around me and I'm having the best time explaining to them how I put it on and when I have to wear it. And so that sort of sets the tone of Amal, who is very feisty, who likes to use her sense of humour to deal with people's stupidity. And really, the book is the first book told by a young Muslim woman about her journey wearing the hijab in a Western society. And for me, it was trying to really counter this kind of crap that we see lining bookshelves and which makes so much money because it reinforces these very entrenched Orientalist stereotypes about Muslim women. And for me, that was my goal, to try and reclaim and shift that narrative and shift that understanding and perception of what it means to be a Muslim woman. At the same time, it's very important for me as a writer not to feel that for people not to feel that I'm trying to represent all Muslim women's experiences. And this is sometimes what a lot of people, the trap they fall into. They think that Amal's experience is universal of all Muslims. And again, it just proves again how hard it is for people to break away from that understanding that the Muslim community is not a monolith and that no one story can represent everyone's story. This is just happens to be Amal's story and her issues with identity. after Does My Head Look Big In This, I had moved from Melbourne to Sydney, and I did feel a difference, Abdul, like you said, between Melbourne and Sydney. I felt that there was a lot more, there were a lot more racial tensions in Sydney, and that might have been because I grew up in the eastern suburbs in Melbourne but had moved to the western suburbs in Sydney. And it was, you know, around about this time that I started to think very seriously about what did it mean to be a young Lebanese person, whether or not you're of Muslim descent, in Sydney. And I started to try and imagine the sort of what the impact of Islamophobia would be on a person who doesn't have the same sort of conviction and strength as Amal does in Does My Head Look Big In This. And I created the character of Jamila in 10 Things I Hate About Me. And Jamila is sort of on the other opposite end of the spectrum. She's embarrassed by her identity because she realises that it is associated with everything that is negative, with violence, with terrorism, and and being from Western Sydney, sort of anxieties about Muslims are sort of pinned onto these landscapes. And so what I was trying to do was to write a story about that sort of impact of Islamophobia on a young person. And Jamila's way of dealing with Islamophobia is something I saw time and time again with friends, which was to withdraw to the safety of anonymity. So Jamila becomes Jamie. She dyes her hair blonde. She wears blue contact lenses. She creates a complete lie at school about who she is, and she divides her world at home and school. And of course, I, as a writer, I will make sure that those worlds collide, forcing her to make a decision about who she wants to be. Because I learned very quickly as a teenager that if you want the respect of others, you have to have self-respect. And I had so many friends who Muhammad became Sam, or, you know, Fatma became, you know, Betty or something like that. You know, it was always strange the names they chose, but who never actually fit in to the sort of culture that they were trying to blend into, and were always at the cusp of both. And so Jamila needs to make that decision pretty quickly. Several of my other books have tried in very subtle ways to deal with different aspects of Islamophobia. So the idea that fiction, that the normative character in fiction is always white. And so if you have a character who isn't white, you feel compelled to describe their skin colour or to explain where their background is from. But if the character is white, you never go to those lengths. And so in my books for children, for middle readers, I populate the books with characters like called Omar and Muhammad, and I leave it at that. And I hope in doing so that young readers are exposed to a repertoire of names and backgrounds without it being an issue-based book. And so they actually see that this is the reality of multiculturalism. And so that a character whose name is Muhammad in a book, there's nothing attached to that name other than the fact that he's a character there. For example, in Noah's Law, which is a legal thriller, my main character Noah, who's 15, is half Egyptian, and I only mention it once. And I hope by the end of the book that my readers have connected with the character and realised that this character isn't just your normative Anglo character. Very quickly, just in relation to my PhD, looking at Islamophobia from the point of view of its perpetrators, I've been interviewing people who profess to have problems with Muslims, and across the spectrum, either those who are, you know, rabidly against Muslims, want to ban Muslim immigration, want, you know, abortion clinics set up for Muslim women, you know, the real sort of crazies, to the, you know, the people who sit in the bulk, you know, I'm not racist, but I have a Muslim friend, I've travelled through Morocco, and then, you know, all sorts. And I sort of out of my research, my field work, I started to think about an idea for a young adult book. So instead of writing my thesis, I started writing a young adult book. And so I've written a book born out of that experience, that field work, which tells a story. It's in a dual narrative structure. Michael, who's 17, who's actually being raised in a family where his parents are against Muslims and have set up a political party to stop Muslim immigration. And he falls in love with a girl called Minna, who's come from Afghanistan 10 years ago. And she completely, you know, rocks his world, because everything that he thought that was right, and the way he's believed about Muslims, about migrants, about refugees, is suddenly turned inside out. And so I'm really trying to look at Islamophobia, but turning the lens back on these, on Islamophobes, and trying to really dig deep into the contradictions. One of the people I interviewed who was against Muslim immigration, against Muslims, ironically had a Japanese wife. And so these are the sorts of contradictions that I find fascinating as a writer. How do people reconcile their racism and Islamophobia on a day-to-day level? Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that so we can open for discussion.
Thank you. Thank you. One of the things I found really striking in, you know, a lot of rich things that you said, but was really about the question of integration. And there's an article by the black British journalist Gary Young, and I'm paraphrasing the title because I can never remember it for some reason, but it's "Where Will We Find the Perfect Muslim for the British State?" And he talks about, many of you will have read it, he talks about, you know, the perfect Muslim is observant but not too religious. His daughters wear the hijab, but he didn't force them. You know, there's all this kind of, basically he's the classic moderate, that moderate Islam that our experts of security and terrorism are wheeled out on the news every day to talk about. And it always reminds me of an anecdote that occurred at a conference that I organized a number of years ago now in Ireland, where a migrant from Nigeria was talking about the fact that he had lived in the country for X amount of years and he had two daughters. Now, you might be aware of the fact that in Ireland, everybody, it's compulsory to study the Irish language. So he decided that his two daughters would learn Irish and they would be better than everybody else. It's quite a difficult language. I studied it for 13 years and I still can't. I can basically say, can I go to the toilet? I mean, it's literally all I can remember because our headmaster used to force us to say it in Irish. Anyway, so these girls were fantastic at Irish, and nonetheless, they keep getting racist abuse. And what he said to me really always struck a chord. He said, where is the office for integration where I can go and I can get the stamp? You have now integrated. You are now an integrated subject. And of course, it doesn't exist because, as he put it, the goalposts keep shifting. And that returns me to a subject we were discussing before the seminar began, which is that of anger. Okay, because if you are in any case never going to be the perfect Muslim subject that Gary Young talks about, why do people keep trying? Okay, and what is to be gained by that? And what would it look like if we were to mobilize our anger against the fact that people have lived here for generations and are still not considered fully Australian or British or French or whatever it may be? What would it look like if we mobilise that productively? Mm. That's a question that I have.
Mm. Well, there's a family in my book, and it does make a little big in this, Amal's uncle, who I modelled on one of our close family friends in Melbourne, who thought that if he looked integrated, he would be more accepted. And so he used to have a lot of the souvenirs in his living room, like flags and koalas and kangaroos. And he would always drop fair dinkum in sentences that it made no sense. And he would say, mate, all the time. And it was so contrived. And it was so sad. There was a real sadness because it was so obvious that he was trying to integrate into this imaginary Australian, you know, national, and he could never match that, because, you know, how do you define it? How do you define Australianness? And, you know, is there a scale of integration? I remember also reading, you know, is a woman wearing a sari with, you know, Queen's English more integrated than somebody who goes to, you know, a mosque in jeans? Like, what are the goalposts? You know, what is the criteria for integration?
The irony here is as well, the more that you appropriate or take up the dominant culture, the more that you become, there's a resentment that comes out of that. Yeah. The proximity of me as a Muslim or as a brown subject, you know, saying fair dinkum triggers certain types of anxieties that you're encroaching on what is my space, you know. And I think part of the integration debate is about, you know, creating two types of positions, one as manager or owner of the place, and the other ones, we're constantly playing the game of trying to achieve some goal. Yeah. And that playing the game establishes the game. Yeah. So, yeah, I have similar family figures, and it is a bit, as you said, sad.
Even with the moderate Muslim, I read an article about, you know, we sort of approach it as though we're ordering, you know, a curry. You know, we don't want two Muslims who are too spicy. We don't want them too bland. You know, we just want them just right. But who sets that criteria? Who chooses the ingredients? You know, and I think it is kind of traumatic to try and think about how you do resist. You know, what do you do in the circumstances where you want to just not play the game anymore? Because, well,
I think your ambiguity does is some form of subversive resistance, but it comes with its price, because being an ambiguous person sometimes makes you kind of that Sadean sense of an exile. You kind of want a home, you want a place where you know. But I think ambiguity does play a part, but it is that question, maybe we're just describing that burden of what it means to have to deal with these constant conversations of trying to get the right temperature of that curry.
Yusia Morsi, postdoctoral research fellow at the University of South Australia, on Big Ideas on RN or online at abc.net.au. Tonight we have highlights of a University of Western Sydney seminar, Being Creative, Resisting Islamophobia. Let's now take a few questions from the audience.
My question plays into the theme we're talking about in terms of generational differences. My father's experience as an immigrant to Australia is very different to mine as a Muslim born and raised here. So he moved here from Lebanon after the Civil War, and notwithstanding the fact that he encountered a lot of racism in the as an employee in the public sector, he still has this attitude of, you should be grateful that you've been given so many opportunities. I didn't have them in my home country. So explaining something like institutionalized racism to him is a completely foreign concept. And it's important not to minimize his experiences, because he lived through the racism that I don't necessarily live with. But how do you reconcile or even engage with that generational difference when you've got people who have lived it but still have a different approach to it, or still think that you need to sort of fit into this more grateful Australian subject?
I come from a different experience. Like, that's a particular one coming from Lebanon, where my father, being a white Australian and having that like Anglo-Aussie background, and my mother coming from Malaysia, there's not this sense of, there's not an expectation that I should be grateful. But I found that a lot with a lot of my friends, and that was a source of a lot of tension. Like, you've got all this, why aren't you happy? But I don't know if it necessarily can be reconciled. If that is that's a hard thing to say, but it's a generational shift. But they won't see it the way we see it, and we won't see it the way they see it.
Seeing some Muslims doing stupid things in the media, which happens. And it's not something specific to Muslims, but they're identified as Muslim, so it's obvious. My father would look at that and say, well, how do you justify that? And while I'm not justifying it, I'm saying there's probably a broader context to what's happening. But he looks at it as, why are you even engaging in this? How do you defend this? How do you explain this?
I can relate to that, because I also have family members who have sort of internalised the idea that they are like a managed minority, like Hassan Hajj says, that they are a minority that's being managed by, you know, the white supervisory will. And they've internalized that in the sense that they feel that their citizenship, their identity, their sense of belonging is negotiable. They're on almost living on a good behavior bond. Yeah. And that any, you know, the slightest disruption, the slightest sense that they are, you know, not towing the line is going to have repercussions on them. And I can understand, you know, it's not something that's born out of a fantasy, because there are repercussions. It takes a lot of resilience to be able to depart from that sort of mindset and actually live your life as though you were sort of insisting on your equality. And that means that you have to accept that there are people who are going to, you know, misrepresent Islam, for example, or behave in ways that you disagree, but that has nothing to do with your identity, and it shouldn't have, or your sense of belonging shouldn't be contingent on other people's behaviour. But I think it takes a lot of courage to do that, and because the repercussions can be quite harsh. And like you said, Yasser, then you become presented as this radical, you know, as this deviant Muslim.
It resonates with me as well, because most, in retrospect, to be honest, at the time I didn't realise this, most of my fight with racism occurs in places of intimacies, whether it's employers or parents or family or community. The racism of me versus stranger happens, but it's how it's filtered through into various different types of relations. The frustration of trying to explain to a parental figure, Yeah, that a lot of what's going on has broader structural, historical influences, brings out a frustration in me, an anger in me, an emotional hurt in me. And then here's a figure I love who's raised me, and they're saying some of the most racist things I've ever heard, you know? And it's that tension. So it's forced me to view racism as conversations, discursive, whatnot, institutional, beyond the individual and person. We're all caught within it and being able to manage with. There is a will of sort. So that, you know, I recognize intuitively what you're saying, and all I can add to it, it's winning the intimate battles as much as winning the battles with the strangers. So much of anti-racism is about sedating the anxieties of the white majority by telling them we're normal, we're not this and that. But it's also about convincing our communities, our families, about the broader material violence that is racism.
Yeah, at the back.
Hi. Because it was said earlier during the discussion that, you know, the definitive story of a Muslim is in the power of the person who's defining it, or the people that are characterising a Muslim in that particular way, that which serves some sort of power structure because people are defining Muslims in a particular way. And then it got me thinking that a lot of that anger or rage that exists in particular that's always sensationalised within young Muslim men is actually young Muslim men or Muslims trying to find a way on how do you counter that narrative, right, that is continually broadcast in the media or within society. And then, Alana, just listen to you with the anecdote regarding the integration stamp and that it doesn't exist as the goalposts continually shift. That exacerbates that anger, I think. So I wanted to put it to you, if I could, and then to the rest of the panel. From an academic perspective, a practical perspective, how do you then rage against the machine, so to speak? Like, how do you now fight back, right? Not in an Orwellian style, but how do you actually fight back to that?
I just think you keep insisting on this truth. I think what often happens, I've written a lot in my own work about the you know, the paradox of the anti-racist racist state. But, you know, there are also anti-racist, racist individuals. So I think I wrote in a recent piece that it's entirely consistent for somebody to think that deaths in police custody is appalling and outrageous, but then not want to send their children to the public school next to them because there are too many Aboriginal kids in it, right? It's entirely consistent. So my point is, a lot of us in academia, especially, I talk about the field that I'm aware of, in private conversations or around the dinner table, will say, oh, it's outrageous, it's appalling. But when there's a racist hiring practice in their faculty, or somebody is overlooked for a job because they're black, or assumptions are made about them because they're Muslim, or this student is badly treated, you know, all of these types of everyday banal racisms, as they're called, as well as the bigger issues, right? They don't talk to them in locations where it could actually change something. So they don't tell their head of department or write to the vice chancellor of the university, or they don't contact the press and say, well, actually, as an academic from this place, I have a certain status and I'm actually going to speak out about this. There are very, very few people. And I think people who have racial privilege, white privilege, it's actually incumbent upon them to use that privilege in order to speak that truth. It's much more difficult for people who are at the pointy end of racism to do that. But actually, think about who does it all the time. It's people like Yasser Rising in the press or speaking out in the media, people like Randa, people like Abdul. It's rarely people who look like me who do that.
On the issue of, anger, I don't necessarily, it won't be a surprise here, I don't necessarily see it as a bad thing, I think. Considering the massive inequalities that we have in the world and so forth, the real question is, why aren't the majority angry enough? You know, when we consider how many Indigenous people have died in custody, why aren't you angry? Yeah? So at one level, anger here is a sense of political consciousness, at one level. The problem is, there's so many checks and balances and handbrakes within our community, as one example, or in the conversation, because anger, you know, you just don't have the luxury of going out, whether you're black or brown, on TV and yelling. You just don't have that luxury because you fit this particular stereotype. And so it actually gets you more angry because it becomes more frustrating for you to articulate the fact that you're animated by the sense of a profound injustice to what's going on. So you're right, there's a level of... But we have to make distinctions here between rage, anger, and so forth, and whatnot, and so forth. But I will say this, and this is why what I mean by racism being quite pervasive and institutional and in the aspect of intimacies. I've lost a lot of friends because they just don't get it. It's like, why is this guy angry? Like, why isn't he grateful? Why is he yapping? Like, I will see some, without naming names or whatnot, I won't, trust me, I will see some museum, not that one, that will celebrate Muslim women in hijabs, and I get angry. And I'm like, you literally turn us into mannequins for the white gaze and so forth, and I can't even articulate it. So to answer your question as an answer to that, I think the better the vocabulary becomes, the broader and wider it becomes, maybe the multiplicities of the story that can help us as quote-unquote a minority tell that colonial story, that anger will be translated into productive narratives. The problem is at the moment when it's isolated and dotted, it's very easy to pick off somebody and say, he's just a prick. Which is the story of my Facebook experience.
Yeah. Thank you.
Quickly, I wanted to ask about, I guess, this phenomenon of double othering, and it's something I've spoken quite widely about with friends and acquaintances over the last few weeks. And it's about Muslims within the Australian Muslim community, which obviously isn't homogenous or monolithic, who aren't practicing, who are secular or who don't practice to... this certain threshold, this expectation. So it's often felt that not only do they face Islamophobia, but they also face this sort of othering within the Muslim community and this rejection and this marginalization and this ostracization that you aren't Muslim enough within Australian, society. You're a bit too Muslim, you're a bit too exotic. So this is something I know that Randa definitely explores in some of her work. But if you guys could quickly elaborate on it, how can we face Islamophobia when within our own communities, there is a very similar sort of othering of people within our communities?
With my work, I've been accused of not being critical enough of the Muslim community and the problems that exist within it. But I think that my work inherently challenges some of those attitudes within the Muslim community. I've described myself as an outsider amongst outsiders. Like, I'm hesitant to say, but I am a Muslim. I'm just terrible at it a lot of the times. I muck up all the time.
then you're both right.
Yeah. Well, so I know exactly what you mean, and the criticism from within the community and criticizing from the out, being too Muslim for some, not Muslim enough for others. It's sort of like you're tiptoeing. It's a fine line.
I think it's like bullying when the bully turns on the weaker person. It comes down to a power game. People who do feel powerless in the wider community will turn on each other and internalise Islamophobia, internalise othering in order to, give themselves some sense of legitimacy. I totally understand where you're coming from, and I think women usually bear the brunt of that. Yeah. In terms of how they represent the Muslim community. I remember before, doing certain interviews, getting lots of emails, what you should say, what you shouldn't say, I'm just offering you some kind advice, and just floods of emails, can you say this, can you not say this, make sure you don't say it in this way, make sure you smile so people see you're a friendly Muslim, but don't smile too much so they don't think you're a bimbo, like all these sorts of... trying to sort of control the image of a Muslim woman. And so you're being policed externally and internally.
Randa Abdel-Fattah, award-winning author and doctoral student at Macquarie University. Also on the panel, we heard from visual artist Abdul Abdullah, Yasir Morsi from the University of South Australia, and thanks to our moderator, Associate Professor Alana Lenton from the University of Western Sydney's Institute for Culture and Society. Being Creative, Resisting Islamophobia was a University of Western Sydney seminar event recorded on the 2nd of December 2014. And that's Big Ideas for this evening and for the week. On behalf of the production team, thanks for your company. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.